don't know. Hey, Mariella, are we handing over to you?
Yes, that's correct, Neely. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, Mariella?
Yes, good morning. Agenda paper 9 includes 4 recommendations on sub-issues we identify when drafting the exposure draft. We will present the first sub-issue and then pause so that board members discuss and vote on question 1, which is after paragraph 26. The first issue deals with the definitions of regulatory asset and regulatory liability, which the board tentatively decided in June 2019. Our recommended changes in the definitions are motivated by, first, the effects of using the phrase amounts already charged to customers, and second, trying to explain better how a regulatory liability arises. The phrase amounts already charged to customers could, as described in paragraph 7 to 9, lead to a risk of double counting contract assets or contract liabilities and regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities. Our recommended definitions replace amounts already charged to customers by references to revenue. In the case of a regulatory asset, that would be the part of the total allowed compensation for goods or services already supplied will be included in revenue in the future. And in the case of the regulatory liability definition, revenue already recognized includes an amount that will provide part of the total allowed compensation for goods or services to be supplied in the future. The definitions in the pre-ballot were based on the wording discussed with the board in June 2019 and also referred to revenue, but did so indirectly through paragraph 11 of the pre-ballot draft, as we describe in paragraphs 9 to 12 of the board paper. The staff have tested these recommended changes against the library of examples we have considered during the project and have confirmed the revision does not change outcomes of applying the definitions. We recommend, we understand that some may have concerns about introducing revenue in the definitions. In particular, in the definition of regulatory asset, which states that part of the total allowed compensation for goods and services already supplied will be included in revenue in the future. Concerns with this phrase arise when part of the total allowed compensation for goods and services supplied in the current period was charged to customers through the regulated rates also in the current period, but is not yet fully recognized as revenue when applying IFRS 15 because of, for example, the entity having customers with high credit risk. The staff note that in such a case, although part of the total allowed compensation has not yet been fully recognized as revenue, the entity does not have an enforceable present right to add that amount in future rates because it has already charged that amount. Thus, the entity does not have a regulatory asset. Another motivation for the recommended changes in the definitions is that the old definition of regulatory liability did not explain clearly how a regulatory liability arises. The definition used in the pre-ballot referred to the total allowed compensation for the goods or services already supplied. However, a regulatory liability arises because an amount already included in the rates and hence in revenue provides part of the total allowed compensation for the goods or services to be supplied in the future. Hence, the entity will need to deduct this amount from the rates to be charged in the future. The changes in the definition explains this more clearly now. So question 1 after paragraph 26 asks whether the board agrees with the definitions stated in this paragraph, in paragraph 26. And I leave then the floor to the board members to discuss.
Mary?
Okay. Mariella, I understand the basic problem that you were trying to address, and actually your tee up addressed what my concern is, which is specifically with introduction of the phrase revenue. So while I don't have an objection to most of the wording changes that you're suggesting making to bring out more fundamentally the basic points that to address the basic points that you got in the feedback. I guess my preference would have been, instead of saying we'll be included in revenue in the future, to say we'll be included in amounts chargeable in the future. And while that might create some burden in terms of explaining what the term chargeable means, I think that that would be relatively easy to do. Now, having said that, if the board does support introducing revenue in there, I think the point that you had in your tee up is one that it will be very important for us to communicate in not only the basis, but I think eventually in the standard, because there, I think many could see a tension between the first half of the definition and the second half. You explained why there's not a tension, and why the point about it's not a right to add an amount to the rate to be charged to customers in the future, that dominates. But I think that has to be made clear so we don't get some seeing this as a tension and relying on rate regulated to overcome the deliberate limits in the revenue recognition standard about revenue recognition in certain circumstances. So my preference would be to address that directly by not using the word revenue and focusing instead on amounts chargeable. But failing that, I think we have to bring out the point that you covered in the TIA.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks, Mary. Jin Chao?
Yes, thank you, Sue. I also will not, objective to the staff's recommendation, provided if the outcome of previous proposal is same as current proposal, that we change the wording from amount charged to the customer to the revenue in the future. If the outcome is same or it's right, it's okay. But I still think that the previous proposal, starting from the amount charged to the customer, and then look at once whether the entity satisfied the performance obligation earlier and later, then you charge amount to the customer, and look at those differences, whether there is any resulting assets or liability. If there are any resulting assets or liability, then those assets or liability will be not considered as regulatory assets and liability, because that is the normal logic, because those assets and liability arising from so-called regulated agreements, those agreements based on the total allowed compensation and also based on the amount that you charge to the customer rather than the revenue you recognize in your account. That is the next step. So it's the natural logic. People always look at, the amounts you charge to the customer. So this kind of, I think this is a little bit similar to Mary's comment. So this is the natural logic. So from my point of view, including change the notion from the amount charged to customer to revenue, it's okay in the definition. But I still hope that in the basis of a conclusion, we're still including those kind of natural logic, starting from the amount charged to customer and to look at those resulting differences because of the performance obligation you satisfied is different from the amounts you charge to the timing you charge to the customer, and then say basically the outcome is same as the revenue recognized. I think it's very easy to be understood, and it's very close to the real a transaction, a real agreement.
Thank you, Jin Chao. Francoise?
Thank you. Sorry for the delay. For the delay. I was having difficulty in unmuting myself. I support the proposal, and like some of my colleagues, I'm not opposed to the use of the term revenue. I think to me it helps clarify what this future standard may achieve. And I think what really needs to be emphasized, I think if we want people to understand why these are assets and liabilities and how all this works, we have to emphasize that for the same transaction, the price that the customer pays is not the price that the entity receives for the same delivery. And I think the change in wording is a good step into that direction, and that's why I support it. And in fact, I think that the improvement is closely linked to having the term revenue used. But of course, it needs to come with appropriate comments in the basis for conclusion that explain that phenomenon very clearly.
Okay. Thank you, Françoise. Daryl.
Thanks, Sue. So a couple of points. I think I agree with Mary's support of moving away from the word amount charged. And I think we all identified through the examples that staff provided as what the concerns were around that terminology. I think Mary probably explained quite well my reservations around moving to the word chargeable, which I just think is introducing a new term that we haven't necessarily defined that may have some of its own problems. So on balance, I'm happy with the idea of moving to the word revenue and using the revenue definition. And I think very much along the lines of what Françoise said is having thought about it and worked through a couple of examples in my own head, I think that does provide the right outcome. That said, I think I support very strongly, Mariella, what you said in your tee-up, and I think what Mary mentioned in her conversation is that I think we need to be drawing attention to cover the tension that might arise in the definition. And it really is about linking that future rate adjustment to future revenue. It's those two parts of the definition that are really critical that we place emphasis on. And whether we do that through some words in the basis that captures all of the discussion we've had around here, or an example or something like that, I think it'd be very useful to just highlight that point and make sure that there is no uncertainty around it. I think the example of the credit risk is a good example because it's one that people can relate to, and it's possibly one that might be very current in people's minds in the current circumstances where some more of those transactions have perhaps been entered into. So I'd support the staff's view, but with that extra emphasis being placed either through the basis or something else.
And personally, if we're going to do that, I'd prefer it's not on the basis, because I don't really want to get into a situation where people are looking at the word revenue up front and then I'm telling them to look at the basis when it comes to the Interpretations Committee, selfishly. So I think it's better to make sure that it's in the requirement, if possible, if we go down that path. Arika?
Thank you, Sue. I think I was struggling with the use of the term like chargeable and billable under IFRS 15 rather than within the framework of related arrangement. So I agree with the staff recommendation, and I really think it's really helpful for the entity to draw a line between the amount belonged to the revenue recognizing IFRS 15 and the amount incurred in connection with regulated arrangement. So I think now it's really helpful idea to proceed. But at the same time, I have a little bit concerned about some clarification might be necessary when we implement the new definition into the text of standard. Because when I look at paragraph 21, within that we have a table shown here, and in connection with regulatory liability and past event column said revenue has already been recognized, but regulatory liability is recognized, right? So I think it's important to clarify that the amount of advance funding is recognized as a revenue under IFRS 15. That kind of the concept will help to understand this new definition. Thank you.
Okay, with that, Anne, you want to come in? Sorry, Anne's got connection problems. Just give her a moment. Okay, I'll talk slowly and see if she comes back on. With that, I think, in Anne's absence, can we please vote on question one, which is on page 8. So I think a few people have suggested we need to be careful with that word revenue. So with that clarification, could I get a show of hands for who supports the staff recommendation in question one?
It looks like we just lost Anne. Do you want to give her a couple seconds to come back on?
I think we're probably better to keep going.
Let's keep going. Right. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Ten, two absent.
No, because I didn't support. So 10, 12. Okay, yes. Yep. Sorry. Doing my math.
Don't confuse matters there. Okay, handing back to you, Mariella.
Yeah, thank you. So we'll continue with regulatory returns on assets not yet available for use. This is covered in the paper in paragraphs 27 and 29, and also in agenda paper 9A. In March 2020, the board discussed regulatory returns on an asset not yet available for use, included in the rate charged to customers during the period the asset is not yet available for use. And the board tentatively decided that those returns should form part of the total allowed compensation for goods and services supplied once the asset becomes available for use. The board has, however, not yet discussed over which period those returns should form part of the total allowed compensation for the goods and services supplied once the asset is available for use, i.e. over the remaining regulatory recovery period or over the asset's useful life. Agenda paper 9A analyzes this matter and recommends that those returns form part of the total allowed compensation for goods and services supplied over the remaining periods in which the entity recovers the carrying amount of the asset through the rates, and that an entity should allocate those returns using a reasonable and consistent basis. This recommendation would also be aligned with previous decisions made by the board. The board has previously tentatively decided that returns on an asset form part of the total allowed compensation over the regulatory recovery period of the asset. This recommendation is in paragraph 29 of agenda paper 9, and question 2 asks whether the board agrees with this recommendation.
Okay, Mary?
Mariella, a suggestion for something, and I think that this really is something that we should do in the basis rather than in the standard, is it took me a while working through those examples to put my finger on why I had a bit of a does this really fit together feeling about it, and I finally tracked it to the fact that in the example of an asset under construction, when and if the regulator allows recovery of that, the cost of the asset before the asset is put into service, we say nope, you know, that creates regulatory, it may be charged to customers, you know, billed to them, but that regulatory expense, so that income is recognized in future when the related depreciation is recognized under IFRS standards. So the period over which it is recognized is based on the IFRS depreciation. And when, however, we come to the regulatory return that's allowed related to that same asset, we're saying recognize the regulatory return over the regulatory period. So in the example, it's years 2 through 4, while the depreciation would have been recognized in years, I think it's 2 through 6. And, you know, I think it's deliberate on the part of the staff to have two different answers for the items that are very closely related. the asset under construction and the regulatory return allowed on the asset under construction. But I think we have to have a bit more of an explanation in the basis, whether it's a cost-benefit reason or a usefulness of information reason, about why we are in what some may see as adding to the complexity, although some may see it as more a practical expedient to have the shorter regulatory period for the return. So that was the bit that I struggled with in terms of understanding what is driving the recommendation of the regulatory period for the regulatory return, while it's the IFRS useful life for the cost of the item itself.
I also tripped on that, Mariella. The way I justified it to myself in the end, see if you agree with me, was that we are doing something different here, but my sort of what I took away from the paper was we're sort of saying that where you have this pre-use difference, for want of a different term, you're basically saying it's not worth the extra complexity of introducing another adjustment for the difference between what the regulator's doing and what the IFRS is doing, because you've already got the complexity of dealing with the pre-use adjustment. So it's sort of a step too far in complexity, which is why we're doing something different here to what we would do, because usually we would look at the depreciation, the useful life for IFRS purposes.
We discussed regulatory returns back in March, and we said that regulatory returns would be reflected as part of total allowed compensation for the goods and services supplied during the period the asset is recovered through the rates. And we reached this conclusion because of cost-benefit considerations. If the asset has a different useful life than the recovery period, allocating those returns on the basis of the goods and services, for example, supplied by the asset in question, could be very burdensome for an entity. That was one of the reasons why we said, well, when the regulatory agreement entitles an entity to include in the rates a return for an asset, we are assuming this corresponds to the total allowed compensation for the goods and services for the period in which the regulatory agreement entitles the entity to do so. So when we have returns on an asset that is still not yet available for use, we are saying those returns should be reflected in profit or loss once the asset is available for use, but over the period in which the asset will be recovered through the rates by the regulatory agreement. If we did recommend to reflect those returns over the useful life of the asset, we would be recommending a recommendation that would not be aligned with what the board already decided back in March for other assets. So it is for cost-benefit grounds and to be aligned with previous decisions by the board.
Anne? Anne, has she been disconnected again?
Yes.
Sorry. Gosh. Having a terrible time. Connection with Australia is not good. Tadao.
Thank you, Sue. Mariella, thank you for the paper. Just talk about the available for use. Can you confirm that this does not cover that kind of incentive purely related to the construction work that is not dependent on goods or services to be provided in the future?
No, this has nothing to do with performance incentives relating to construction works. This is purely returns that a regulatory agreement entitles an entity for amount invested in an asset during the period the asset is not yet available for use. It's different from performance incentives for works carried out during construction work. It's a different matter.
Okay, excellent. And I do support, and based on the papers that I have already read in relation to this one, that it is different, a situation that is not rate regulated, and then we have to have a link between the revenue and the depreciation of the assets. When we are discussing rate regulated, it makes sense to do this, let's say, simplification that you are proposing. I do support your proposal.
Okay, thank you. I think Anne was with us, but I think Anne, have you gone again?
Yes, I'm back again. Sorry about that, everybody. I've had a few problems. Mariella, so this is in relation to question two, in paper nine, you just stated it briefly, and we'll be using the period of the regulatory agreement, and that's what we decided before, and we carry that over in this paper. But the issue you wanted to, us to consider in 9A was about the end of the period, and I do support what you're proposing, staying with the period from the regulatory agreement. But I did get confused. I did get confused in the paper about the difference in the end period. You said, you know, in one scenario, the end period isn't an issue, but it's specified in one scenario. But in the second scenario, the end period isn't specified. So you spent a long time explaining to us about the end period. But I couldn't understand. You know, we've got these two scenarios. One is where the regulatory agreement starts the recovery in the pre-period. And in the second scenario, it doesn't. It starts it in the post-period.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand why one scenario you say the end period is specified, but the other one it's not. I got lost there.
I think it might be confusing sometimes. You are comparing Appendix A with Appendix B probably as well.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Yes,
so okay. So in Appendix A, the method, the regulatory approach is FUTC. So in that approach, the regulator gives the entity returns on an asset not yet available for use, but it only allows the entity to charge those returns during the operation phase of the asset. And in that respect, then, we would be applying the principles of target profit, and we would say that those returns that the entity earned during the construction of this asset, but that the regulator entitles the entity only to charge to customers during the operating phase of the asset should be recognized in profit or loss during the recovery period of the asset. So when we are in the case of AFUDC, applying the requirements that we have or the principles that we have for target profit and returns would make it. We don't have to worry about it. What happens in the second case, and that would be Appendix B, is that in that case, the entity is also being offered regulatory returns on an asset not yet available for use, but it is allowed to charge those returns during the construction period. So in this case, we have to make two decisions. The first decision is, do we reflect those returns during this construction period, or do we reflect those during the operating phase? And the board already made the decision that those returns should form part of total allowed compensation during the operating phase. Now, up to when now? And this is when we have two possibilities. Using the useful life of the asset, we are going to be reversing this regulatory liability, or using the regulatory recovery period of the asset. If those two periods are the same, we don't have a problem. We apply, again, the principles that we have for regulatory returns, and we would be recognizing those throughout the recovery period, which in this case is also the useful life of the asset. But when those two periods differ is when we had to specify in the EV what was those periods. And Agenda 9A recommends that this period in which the regulatory liability reverses be the same period as when the entity recovers any remaining carrying amount of the asset through the rates. That's why we have two different periods in Appendix B.
Yeah, I'm obviously not communicating what my concern is here. I understand everything you've said about what we decided beforehand and what's being presented now. I just don't understand the why the end period differs. So I'll take up the conversation offline with you, Mariella.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Françoise?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to express support for the staff recommendation. They're very much on the same line of argument as Tadeo.
Okay, thank you. Jin Chao?
Thank you, Sue. Basically, as the post-staff's recommendation, I think it's very useful to clarify the period
you know, those when those regulatory return will form part of the total loan compensation, particularly when there will be end. Particularly if the useful life of the assets is longer than a so-called, and Mary said, that regulatory life. So in this case, I don't think that if those, you know, a regulatory term will be recovered longer than regulatory life. I think it will not be understood by users. I think, you know, because the regulatory life have already ended before the useful life of the assets. So in this regard, I agree. And there may be another scenario, maybe the use of life of some of the assets, because sometimes the assets not one asset, there are several assets, as we have mentioned before. So maybe the use of life of some of the assets shorter than regulated life. But in this case, because of the complexity or the cost consolidation, we simplified the approach. So basically, I agree with staff's recommendation. But when I read, I have a little bit concern about the complexity of the calculation of the regulatory term. When I read the paper 9A, for example, figure A4, when we try to calculate each year's regulatory return, and how can we each that achieve that number? And it seemed to me that first the company needed to calculate the regulatory return based on the regulatory capital base before deducting the regulatory liability. Then the entity needed to calculate the regulatory interest expense, and then reach the first part of the regulatory return, that is the year to the return, and then try to plus the, you know, the regulatory return accumulated during the construction period, which will be, you know, allocated evenly in the remaining period. From my point of view, I'm not sure whether the entities really do need to calculate the regulatory interest expense based on the, you know, regulatory term previously recognized in during the construction period. It really adds complexity, because for me, when I look at these examples, I spend, you know, a little more, many time to understand the numbers. Actually, it's very straightforward. Simply just to calculate that regulatory return based on the opening balance of the assets, and then timed the regulatory return rate, that's 8%. Exactly, directly can achieve the 66 that amount of the regulatory return. And the company do not need necessary to, you know, calculate regulatory interest expense first, and then deducted that number from the 80, you know, 6, and then achieved the 66. I think it will reduce the complexity and reduce the cost for companies to achieve that number. But this is, you know, just I'm not sure whether we are going to include this kind of number example in the basic conclusion or something like that. But when we, you know, illustrate how or guide the entities how to achieve that regulatory return number, I hope that we can simplify the methodology we used, the how to calculate that that number.
Yeah, so if I may add to this, figure A4 are not requirements per se, it's a breakdown of elements that would the elements of which this profit of 9370 and 49, the regulatory returns basically are made of. So it is a further analysis provided in this figure about the bottom line.
And just to add to Mariela's point, this is not a requirement, as Mariela mentioned. We are just illustrating the different components making up the regulatory return. An entity would need to calculate the regulatory interest expense on the the regulatory liability or regulatory assets, so that an entity would need to do, and that's a specific requirement. But this sort of a reconciliation is not a requirement per se. It is just for information purposes, just for users to understand what that return is comprised of.
Thank you. Rika?
Thank you, Sue. I agree with the staff recommendation because I think the regulatory recovery period is determined based on the regulated agreement with the regulator. Besides, the useful life of asset should be a separate decision made by an entity considering the economic substance of the asset themselves. So I think the separate determination should be made between the two periods of life. So I think I also think alignment between those two periods can distract our proposed framework as a whole. So I strongly agree with the staff recommendation.
Thank you. I think with that, we're ready to vote on question two, which is at the top of page 10 of agenda paper 9. Could I get a show of hands on who supports the staff recommendation?
We have 11. I can do math. 11, one absent. I'm sorry, 10, one absent.
You counted Ann?
I counted Ann, yeah. Zach, you're not supporting? No, okay. So 10, one absent.
Okay. Hand it back to Mariella.
Mm-hmm. Effective date. This is covered in paragraph 30 to 31 of Agenda Paper 9. The board has not yet decided the implementation period in which entities should apply the final standard upon its publication. The staff recommend a period of 18 to 24 months because the staff believe that period would allow entities sufficient time to make any necessary changes to their systems and procedures. This recommendation reflects the fact that to a large extent, the proposed model uses information that the staff expect preparers already need to gather and process in determining regulated rates. Question three, after paragraph 31, asks the board whether the board agrees with the staff recommendation that entities should apply the final standard for annual reporting periods beginning on or after a date of 18 to 24 months from the date of its publication.
Can we just vote on that? Can I get a show of hands on question three?
At 12, one absent.
Okay, Mariella?
And comment period, that's going to be the last item, paragraphs 32 to 36 of the paper. In July 2019, the board tentatively decided to set a comment period of 120 days for the exposure draft. The staff recommend that the board considers a longer comment period to provide stakeholders with more time to manage the effects and constraints that COVID-19 might have on their ability to develop their feedback on the exposure draft. The staff recommend that the board extend the comment period from 120 to 180 days. The board has discussed its work plan this morning, and the expected publication date of the exposure draft is now January 2021. So assuming publication in January 2021, a 180-day comment period would end in July 2021. Question four, after paragraph 36, asks whether the board agrees with the staff recommendation to extend the comment period of the exposure draft from 120 to 180 days.
Nick?
Thanks, Sue. So although the revised publication date or expected publication date takes this out of the holiday season, as being suggested in the paper originally, I think the reality is that our stakeholders are dealing with a substantial pipeline of consultation documents at the moment, together with the challenges of COVID-19. And to me, the best way to give them the flexibility to manage that workload is to extend the comment period as proposed in this document. So I support the staff recommendation here.
I don't support the staff recommendation, particularly if this document goes out in January, so it's not straddling a holiday period. The comment periods will have ended for Goodwill and for primary financial statements before this document goes out. And I think we're getting into a bit of a, I know we've got a COVID situation, but I think we are getting into a tendency of tipping towards longer consultation periods almost routinely. And I think we just need to be conscious of the perception of how long it takes us to get stuff done. Mary?
Mariella, I wondered with the recent decision about, you know, the nudge in the timeline for publication, whether we should be talking about 150 days rather than 180 days, you know, on the basis that if we had published in December, I'm trying to get to the same place we would have in terms of the end of the comment period, because I'm sensitive to Sue's concerns. You know, the other thing we could do is stick with the 120 days that we decided on initially, and then monitor how people are coping and whether or not we have to extend, because I think I'd rather be extending comment deadlines in response to demand from stakeholders rather than just kind of automatically at the beginning.
Daryl?
Mute.
There you go. Off mute. Sorry, that's a few minutes. Sue, I'm probably very much in the space you're in on this one. I think I'm very concerned that we're moving further and further away from the standard of 120 days. I think now that we've moved the date from December through to January, we've taken out some of the reason for delay. I think in particular, this project has got a very targeted group of companies that will be looking at what's actually happening. There are a group of companies that have followed the project very closely. And every interaction of our auditors in the space has, if anything, been encouraging us to move along faster. So as much as I appreciate Nick's point about COVID and things like that in the background, I think this is probably an industry that is ready for us to move quicker rather than slower. And I think we should make the most of that. And as you mentioned, Sue, a lot of the other things that we're consulting on will be out of the way by the time we get this document out. So I would certainly be very much in favor of 120 days, second best 150 days, worst case 180 days.
Anne, are you frozen? Are you?
No, I'm here, I hope. I support 120 days. I think I agree with Daryl. My point was that I'd heard that there were people that were very keen to get this going and get this happening. It's not for the wider community. It's a narrow group of people who are concerned. So I thought to stay with 120. Thank you.
Françoise?
Yes, about the same line. In fact, I was ready to say 150 days and end up at the same place as was suggested with a publication date in December. But I'm attracted to 120, provided that during that period we are able to conduct a thorough field test, which from my point of view is required in more particularly in this exposé draft. I'm sensitive to what Mary has said. I mean, I think we could decide 120 and then eventually extend by 30 days if there are requests by people involved.
Nick, want to come back in?
Just to reflect that we do have a substantial pipeline coming up. We'll have management commentary exposure draft, targeted standard level review of disclosures, which is substantial piece have to work, business combinations under common control, PIR, request for information, 10, 11, 12. And this is something I have heard from stakeholders already, a concern. This isn't a theoretical concern that I'm expressing. It's just the sheer weight of documents plus COVID considerations on top of that. Thank you.
Okay, so shall we start with asking whether you agree with the staff's recommendation of a comment period of 180 days?
Rika wanted to come in, Sue.
Oh, sorry, Rika. Sorry, I was watching the room and missed the screen. Rika?
That's okay. Thank you, Sue. I think I understand the importance in the specific industry regarding the development of this new standard. But at the same time, when considering December year-end companies, also auditors of those companies will be very busy during January, February timeframe. So I'm just wondering, 150 days is one of the options we can take in between 120 and 180 days.
Okay. To be fair to the staff, I'll start with their recommendation and we'll work from there. So, can I get a show of hands for who supports the staff recommendation of a 180-day comment period?
We have five in favour, one absent.
Okay. All right. So we'll now ask for bids for 150 days.
Okay.
We have seven in favour, one absent.
So that's enough. Yeah?
Seven in favour, one absent. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So 150. Successfully sitting on the fence. Okay. Is that all you needed from us, Mariella?
Yes, that's everything we needed from the board members today.
Okay, excellent. Happy drafting.
Thank you.
With that draws today to a close. So thank you very much.
Thank you.